Welcome back to the Dirt Show. I'm podcasting today from beautiful downtown Las Vegas, where I'm here to make a speech about Israel and the Middle East. Speaking of Israel and the Middle East, Hamas now claims that it can't come up with the 40 hostages that both the United States and Israel agreed to accept in exchange for releasing 1,000 murderers and Israel having a ceasefire, a completely one-sided and unfair deal. But Hamas says it can't come up with the 40 hostages that fit the profile. The profile was that they would release all the women and all the elderly and the infirm men, keeping behind only Israeli soldiers or military age men. But Hamas claims it can't come up with them because many of them are being held not by Hamas, but by other terrorist groups, which they should have control over, and by civilians. And let me tell you a story about that. So a nurse named Neely Margolet, a 40-something-year-old nurse, who was captured and kidnapped. She was hiding in a safe room with a group of other people from a kibbutz. She managed to escape. The others were all killed, murdered, burned to death, or shot to death. And then she came out and she was captured, not by Hamas, by civilians who had come following Hamas when Hamas went first, broke down the fences, started killing people. And then they were followed by these ordinary civilians in Gaza, these people that were shedding so many tears over. Oh, my God, Israel's killing civilians. Well, let me tell you about some of these civilians. So this group of civilians came over and they killed bunches of people. And then they kidnapped Neely Margolet, a nurse. What do you think they did? They sold her like a slave, like a common slave, as if she were in Egypt or in the South during slavery. They sold her to Hamas. But before they sold her to Hamas, these wonderful civilians, these civilians of Gaza, they came out and presented her to other civilians, Gazan civilians. And the Gazan civilians were jubilant, that's her word. And they cheered the other civilians. These are the civilians that people are shedding tears about. These are the innocent civilians? No. So many of the innocent civilians, so-called, are people who were complicit in October 7th, came over and participated. They're civilians. Others allowed their homes to be used to store rockets. Others today are holding hostages. Civilians are holding hostages, guarding them for Hamas. And now Hamas can't get them back. Why? I don't know. Is it an excuse? Don't know. But when you hear that a civilian was killed in Gaza, just think, what kind of a civilian was it? Was it a baby? If so, then shed tears. Was it a five-year-old or seven? What was a child? Well, you know who children are in Hamas counting? 19-year-old terrorists count as children. 25-year-old women count as women. So when Hamas says, oh, half the people were children and women, yeah, but how many of them were terrorists? So always think hard when you hear about civilians. If they're babies, horrible. If they're members of the World Kitchen, horrible. But if they're people who were involved in October 7th, if there were people who used their homes, if there are people who allow their children to be used as human shields, for example, the head of Hamas's three children were killed. Oh, all the stories, three children, his three children were killed, the 35-year-old terrorists. They're not children, they're his children, but they are members of Hamas military. Then his grandchildren were killed. Why? Because they were with his terrorist children. You shed the tears over the grandchildren, and then you blame the parents for why. Why they were killed. The parents are terrorists and they're appropriate, decent, reasonable targets. So don't give me tears about the head of Hamas's children being killed. They're perfectly appropriate military targets. They were high-ranking members of the military, terrorists themselves, people who deserve to die because they killed. And so newspaper accounts, children, the children of the Hamas leader. Yeah, he could be 60 years old and be a child of someone, but they're not children. They're adult terrorists. All right, got that out of my system. Let's turn now to another thing I want to get out of my system. So I've read all the questions that the judge and everybody else is going to ask the potential jurors starting on Monday. They are a terrible list of questions. They are designed not to ferret out people. Pardon me, I have my allergies come out. But not designed to ferret out people who would have a prejudice. The questions almost all go something like this. For example, here's one. Do you have strong opinions about Trump? All right, that seems okay. But then it continues. Do you have strong opinions about Trump that would interfere with your ability to be a fair and impartial juror? That's not a question. That's an answer. If you ask anybody, do you have anything that would interfere with your ability to be a fair and impartial juror? The automatic answer is no. You don't ask a dumb question like that, whether you're a judge, a defense attorney, or a prosecutor. You never ask the question, can you give a fair trial? Would this interfere with your right to your ability to have a fair trial? They're always going to answer no, unless they want to get off the jury. Then they will maybe lie and answer yes. But anybody who wants to be on the jury is going to answer any question that ends with that could interfere with your ability to be a fair and impartial juror. Oh, no, I'm a fair person. I hate Donald Trump. I think he ought to go to jail. If he were assassinated, I think that would be a good thing. But I don't. That wouldn't interfere with my ability to be a fair and impartial juror. It's the most absurd question. I've been doing this 60 years. And I have to tell you, picking a jury can be one of the most important parts of a trial. But the idea, the very idea that you're asking the jurors whether they can be impartial, no, that's for you to decide. That's for the defense and the prosecution to ferret out and for the judge to decide. The question should be, do you have strong opinions about Trump? Either way, even that's not a good question. The question I would ask would be something like this. Have you ever discussed Donald Trump with anybody, with a friend or a relative? If they say no, strike them. They're lying. Nobody in the world has never discussed Donald Trump. Okay. So they'll say, if they're honest, oh, yes, we've discussed Donald Trump. What exactly did you say about him? What exactly did you say? Then we can decide whether you have the ability to give a fair trial. But don't ask them whether they can give a fair trial. Of course, they're going to answer that question. Yes. Get the information. Find out, do you listen to Sid in the Morning? Do you listen to CNN? Have you ever heard a CNN legal analyst discuss this case? If so, who? Have you ever heard an MSNBC analyst discuss this case? You know, I've seen those stations, and they all say this is a slam dunk case. This is an easy case. This is a very strong case. That's what they say on CNN. That's what they say on MSNBC. They say something different on Fox. They say something different on MSNBC. So find out what they watch, if they'll tell you the truth. Find out what they read. Find out who they talk to. I think in a case like this, you should be able to find out who they voted for. They're not obligated to tell you that, but you can ask them that question. You can ask them if they contributed to either party's campaign. For example, they have a question, do you have any biases against Trump? But they don't ask, do you have any biases in favor of Biden, the opposite side of the coin? Do you have any views, strong views of Biden? Whenever there's a question about Trump, you should ask a question about Biden, because if they support Biden, if they favor Biden, then they don't favor Trump. So what is necessary and what's not done well in these questions is to get the facts, just the facts, the information. about what's being read, what's being heard, what's being listened to. And most important, have you ever discussed Donald Trump with anybody? Have you discussed Joe Biden with anybody? Have you discussed the upcoming election with anybody? Have you discussed January 6th with anybody? What have you said about January 6th? What have you said about the claims that the election were stolen? Did you say they were outrageous? Did you say they were plausible? What did you say? What we need to find out are the facts. And we know, my friend Arthur Idala gave an interview to the Times today in which he said, and of course he's right, he said it directly, jurors lie. They lie to get on the jury, they lie to get off the jury. But the one thing you know is they lie. And you have to ask them the kinds of questions that are harder to lie about. It's easy to lie about, would you be a fair juror? Or how do you disprove that? Of course, everybody's going to be a fair jury. But if you ask, did you ever discuss Trump with somebody? And the answer is no. And then somebody comes forward and says, wait a minute, we were at a bar two nights ago. The guy was railing against Trump. That's perjury. You can find that out. So the key is facts, 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 information, not opinion. Yeah, you can ask about opinions, but not opinions about whether you can give a fair trial. Ask opinions about Trump. Ask opinions about Biden. Ask opinions about Democrats and Republicans. Excuse me. But that's not what these questions are doing. And the question, of course, is not so much what written questions will be asked, but what the judge will allow them to pursue. And you know, the questioning of jurors serves two purposes. One, a legitimate purpose, and the other, not so legitimate purpose. The legitimate purpose is to disqualify jurors, not to qualify them, because you have no control over them. They're just rote taken out of a machine and put there. But you can disqualify them on two grounds. You can disqualify them for cause. For example, if somebody says, I only listen to MSNBC and I only listen to Joe Scarborough, throw him out for cause. He's so biased, so one-sided. If the person says, I only listen to CNN, same thing. If they only listen to Fox, well, maybe. Fox has presented a much more two-sided approach to these trials than CNN or MSNBC has. But you have to be able to probe more deeply into the answers that people give. So that's one purpose, to get rid of jurors that would be unfair. The second is to use your questions, and this is of questionable validity, but it's done all the time by criminal lawyers. You use the questions as a way of trying to influence the jurors. Not only assure yourself that the jurors are fair, but hope that the jurors will be fair on your side. Let's remember another thing. Nobody wants a fair jury. Nobody wants a fair jury. No judge wants a fair jury. No juror, no prosecutor wants a fair jury. No defense attorney wants a fair jury. They want a jury that's going to come out their way. And they think that's a fair jury. If they convict, that's a fair jury. Or if you're a defense attorney, if they acquit, that's a fair jury. Of course, in this case, a victory for Trump doesn't necessarily mean a 12-0 verdict of acquittal. It can mean a 10-2 verdict of conviction, with the two standing firmly to their view. So one of the things you want to find out, if you're a defense attorney, lawyer, you want to get jurors who will stick to their opinions, who won't be swayed. You all remember 12 Angry Men. You want jurors who, if they're voting for acquittal, will stick to it, even if there's a lot of compulsion on the other side. And the judges exercise compulsion. They give what criminal lawyers call either the dynamite instruction, but I call it the ex-lax instruction. It's designed to loosen them up a little bit and let them come to a verdict. And there's pressure to come to a verdict. There shouldn't be. If the vote is 10-2, it should be a hung jury. There should be no pressure for a unanimous jury. There's no virtue in a verdict. There's virtue in a result. And a result can be a hung jury. And if it's 10-2 or or you know, 6 to 6, whatever it is, that should stand after a certain number of hours. What you don't want is people to be using their influence on other jurors. And what you have is often jurors consist of people who are professionals, sometimes lawyers, and lay people. And sometimes the lay people are more influenced by the lawyers. Now, of course, what the Trump people want are ordinary folks, you know, who right out of subways. They're going to get some Democrats, obviously, but they want, if they can, policemen, firemen, secretaries, people who work in the garment district, people who are physical laborers. That's what they want. I think the prosecution wants college graduates, people who are elite, people who are firmer in their views. You know, what they get will depend a lot on the judge. So there are two types of challenges, as I think I mentioned on the previous show. There's the challenges for cause, and that's always up to the judge. And then there are the peremptory challenges. And the peremptory challenges are, just don't like this guy. Don't like the way he looks. I don't like the way she looks. I don't like the way she's looking at me. Throw him off. You only have a limited amount there, and you have to be sure to save at least one peremptory challenge if you get somebody toward the end who's really, really terrible, but you can't get them dismissed for cause. So it's a strategy. It's a tactic. And it could have a big effect on the outcome of the case, especially a case like this, which is weak on the merits, which could go either way, which, if it weren't in New York City, wouldn't have been brought. And if it were brought, it resulted in an acquittal. Again, just to go over what a weak case it is, the claim essentially is that he paid, there was a non-disclosure agreement, perfectly legal, paid her money. In exchange, she promised not to disclose that, and then he failed to disclose it. Now, in order to win the case, the prosecution has to prove, essentially, that the only reason that he failed to disclose it was to impact the election, which is absurd. Of course he had multiple reasons. Of course he wanted to impact the election. You always do if you're a candidate, but he also wanted to prevent embarrassment to his wife, prevent embarrassment to his children. Who would want to disclose the fact that he paid money to a former porn star? There are so many multiple reasons for that, but for the government to win, they have to prove that the primary reason was to influence the election. Well, the primary reason for bringing this lawsuit was to influence the election. But you're not going to be able to prove that. If that were able to be proved, the prosecutor would be disbarred. But how do you get into the minds of either the prosecutor or the defendant in this case? How do you figure out what their primary motive is, you know, and why a person would pay hush money? Was it to influence the election? He had already been painted in such a negative way sexually. Remember the tape recording from that TV show. Well, you know, if you're a celebrity like me, they let you touch, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That was pretty awful. And the day after that came out, everybody thought that cooked his goose. Well, no, it didn't. Even though he was running against a feminist and a woman, it didn't cook his goose. And he was able to overcome that, and probably would have been able to overcome paying hush money or a non-disclosure money to a former porn star. Remember, he denied that he ever had any relationship with her, just as he paid the money to avoid the embarrassment of a lawsuit. And I'm sure at least part of the reason was to avoid the embarrassment to his wife. Now, there are two kinds of embarrassment. One, having your wife know about it. That's one kind. I don't know whether his wife knew about it or not. But the other is, even if your wife knows about it, it's worse if then the public knows about it and the wife seems like she is tolerating a man who is doing things like that, having an affair with a porn star. So the reasons for paying the hush money, the non-disclosure money, are obviously multiple. And the question is, what kind of a jury is more likely to understand that? For example, if you get a male juror who has himself, you know, had affairs and that kind of thing, which he didn't want his wife to know about, that might be somewhat more sympathetic, but you can't ask about questions like that. But what's going to happen in this case, interestingly enough, unlike the previous case, the federal case, where I think he did not get a trial, in the federal case, the judge did not allow disclosure of the names of the jurors, and the jurors remain anonymous, I think, to this day, if I'm not mistaken. And the jurors and the judge instructed the jurors, please don't talk about it with anybody. In this case, the defense and the defendant will learn the name of the jurors. We won't, but they will. And so they can do an analysis of the jurors. They can go on social networks. They can find out, they're not getting the addresses, but they can find out probably what neighborhood they're from and ask about them and get more information about what kind of people these jurors are. So at least there'll be some opportunity to get relevant information about them and to find out whether they'd be biased or not, and to interview, to send out investigators to interview their friends. Now, do they have enough time to do that? I mean, there are two issues. One, find out about the jurors, potential jurors, in order to disqualify them. But then, once the jury is seated, 12 jurors plus six alternate, 18 altogether, once that happens and the jury is locked in, you still want to find out as much as you can about the jurors in order to be able to frame strategies, tactics, legal arguments, witness decisions that fit their profile, that comport with who they are. You want to find out about their political affiliation, about their religious affiliation, about who they respect, who they admire. Once you know what the jury is, whether it's composed of primarily women, whether it's racially mixed, you also may want to change your legal team a little bit. If it's a predominantly female jury or predominantly black jury, you may want to get a lawyer who reflects the same ethnicity or gender as some of the jurors, or you might at least have one lawyer there who could examine one or two witnesses, but who might be more sympathetically received than other lawyers. These are all very, very hard questions, and these are what you get paid for if you're a lawyer, and if you're a good lawyer. And I think the lawyers in this case generally are pretty good. And let's see what the evidence is. A decent judge would probably dismiss this case at the close of the government's evidence, because they're not going to be able to prove a crime. But I don't think this judge is going to do it. Okay, so let's turn to some questions. Let's see, because I'm far away. I don't have the usual ability to just print out the question. So, okay, let's see where we're going. Okay, here's one question. It's more of a statement than a question. Your ability to withstand and share what no human should ever have to go through is commendable. That was the reference to that really lovely letter I got about, you know, me being a Jew. This unspeakable horror needs to be brought to light and kept in plain view. A spotlight must never fail to show the truth, and lessons must be learned about the value of every human life that was violently taken. Crimes against Jews are what we must acknowledge and never forget. Look, I agree. Look, crimes against anybody must be acknowledged. The difference is what Israel did is not a crime. What Israel did has been self-defense. They made a mistake. So did the United States. The United States made a more serious mistake when they killed an aid worker and his children. Children. But Israel made a terrible mistake too, and it was based on the same kind of misinformation. They both honestly believed they were attacking terrorists, and they both ended up killing an AIDS worker and children in one case, and seven AIDS workers in another case. And you must distinguish between the AIDS worker, between mistakes like that, and the deliberate mass murder of 1,200 people and the kidnapping of 260 other people. Okay. Good argument, Dersh. Einstein's letter is exactly reference to this point. And even more so now that we learn that Hamas is using civilians to hold and guard their hostages. And we now know that some of the people who kidnapped at least this one woman, Neely, Margalit, were civilians. And so the Einstein letter really resonated with me, and I'm glad to have it. Red line, leave the Democrats party. It's not too late. I don't want to vote for Trump, but I refuse to vote for anyone who does not stand strong for Israel. Look, it's not even a question of standing strong for Israel. It's a question of keeping your commitments. And now we're seeing, 58 Democrat members of Congress, 58 of them are saying that Israel should have a unilateral ceasefire. According to a report I read just before I came on the podcast tonight, at least it's alleged that Biden is demanding Israel have a ceasefire even before it gets any hostages back. That's absurd. Israel should not listen to Biden or to the Democrats. Israel has to do what it has to do to protect itself, just like the United States did what it had to do after 9/11. And of course, going to Afghanistan and Iraq and other places was not nearly as essential to America's national security as Israel going 5 miles into Gaza to prevent a recurrence of what happened on October 7th. So Israel has to do what Menachem Begin did when he talked to then Senator Joe Biden back, 30 years ago, and he said, look, I'm not a sniveling Jew who just listens to other people. I represent a great people who have been around for 3,000 years, and I'm not going to sacrifice their existence or well-being to satisfy a few hard left radical 58 congressmen and ignoramuses like some of the senators who want to see a ceasefire. Elizabeth Warren, my colleague for 25 years, simply doesn't know what she's talking about. She has no idea of what international law is. She has no idea what genocide means. It's just that she hates Israel. And she's willing to entertain the idea that Israel is guilty of genocide. It's the most absurd argument imaginable. If Israel is guilty of genocide, then America has been guilty multiple times, over and over and over and over again in Great Britain and other countries. Israel has not committed genocide. Israel has committed self-defense. And in the process of committing self-defense, some civilians have died, some real civilians, some fake civilians. But most of them have died because Hamas has a policy of using them as human shields. How dare you even suggest genocide? Liz Warren, I told you a long time ago, you will never get my support when you refuse to even come and listen to a speech given by then Prime Minister of Israel. You wouldn't come. You wouldn't listen. You sat there like the monkey, you know. And now she's like the monkey. She doesn't hear, she doesn't see, but she talks. She talks nonsense that Israel is possibly guilty of genocide. And then she tried to take it back. Oh, well, I didn't mean I think they're guilty of genocide. I think that the International Court of Justice will find them guilty of genocide. And there's a basis for that. No, there's no basis for it. No basis whatsoever. So my red lines are getting close. I'm not going to quit the Democratic Party unless and until they actually cut off military equipment for Israel. But if they do, I'm done. And I will publicly announce I am no longer a Democrat. I'm no longer associated with the Democratic Party. I may follow what has been said here. I don't know who I'd vote for. I might vote for Bobby Kennedy. I've never stayed home. I don't think I can stay home. No labels. We'll see who they come up with. But I could not vote. I could not vote a Democrat. And so we'll see what happens. You can thank Barack Obama for the U.S. attitude on Israel within the Democratic Party. Started with him. I agree with him 100%. I made a terrible mistake by voting for Barack Obama the second time. Look, I knew him. I knew him as a student. I liked him. You know, he was Barry. He would come sit outside my office, cigarette dangling out of his mouth, wearing the leather jacket, seeming like a tough guy. You know, talking very differently. When he talked to professors, he would talk the King's English. And when he talked to his friends, he would, you know, talk a very different way. And I guess other people are that way as well. But I liked him. And he invited me to the White House over and over again to state dinners, to celebrate the Medal of Freedom. And I fell for it. I really thought during his first term, he did a credible job. And then when he was no longer subject to election, his true self came out and he became virulently, virulently anti-Israel. And so I have no relationship with him whatsoever now. I regard him as an enemy of justice, an enemy of Israel, and an enemy of decency. And I will never, ever, ever support him in any possible way. I just hope, that it's not true of Biden, but I keep an open mind. See you next week.